One second, please.
Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Uh-oh.
I wanna go.
Don't show me in the outer space.
Welcome back, everybody. It makes me laugh every time I hear it. Every time I hear it. That's from inside Llewellyn Davis, Coen Brothers, and Adam Driver. Adam Driver. JT, man. That's a great movie. That's a really, really great movie. So, anyway. Hey, welcome back, everybody. It's Nick DiGilio here. We're live in the Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. Triple Play Thursday, get your requests and we'll play them later. It's one artist, three songs. Joining us right now for his monthly visit is Rod Pyle. He's an author, a journalist. He's an editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine for the National Space Society. And you can check out pylebooks.com. That's P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. We'd love to have Rod on to talk space and more. So let's get Rod in here. Hey, Rod, how are you, man?
Good. How are you doing?
Not bad. Good to hear from you, as usual. Always a pleasure.
It is so nice to be here. After the end of the Apollo 11 anniversary, I can't tell you.
Yeah, well, okay, let's start with that, man. Well, first of all, like we always do, tell everybody a little about yourself, how you got into the space business and all that.
Born almost the same time as the space age and grew up with rockets getting bigger and bigger and everything happening for the first time. And was just about the right age to really be completely smitten with the whole first round of Apollo flights and the first landing on the moon and all the way through that. And then decided I wanted to try and be a scientist. And after differential calculus and I made our acquaintance, decided that was probably not going to be a good idea after all. I went into media. And about 2005, I started writing books. And then a few years ago, I had the good fortune to meet you, and my career was made.
Well, I appreciate that. It's always a great time to have you on. So the Apollo 11 anniversary, man, it was all over the place. And how did you survive? I know that you were unbelievably busy during that whole time period. How did it go for you?
I was. It was hundreds and hundreds of non-billable hours. It was great. You know, I mean, authors spend a lot of time working by themselves, and it's not like most of us get that much public recognition, except infrequently. So it was really fun to have a couple of months of doing four or five interviews a day and doing a couple of talks a week and going all over the place. But by the end of it, I was kind of on my hands and knees. You know, you've been through this, I'm sure. You're just at the end of this big media spree, and then it just came to an end, like a hatchet dropped on it. You know, done, that's it, it's over.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, went through a couple of days of kind of being in a little bit of a funk, like, oh, gee, nobody loves me anymore. But, we'll have another one for Apollo 13. And then it's going to be kind of interesting, you know, in my circle of friends who are largely space journalists and authors and TV people and so forth, there was a lot of head scratching about, you know, how big a deal is this anniversary really going to be? Because we thought it might be huge, but we also thought it might kind of not really hit the marks that we were expecting, but I think it did overall. And what I'll be interested to see, I expect Apollo 13 to be kind of a big deal because it was such a fine piece of drama, the way it was portrayed in the film and so forth.
Yeah.
Apollo 17 is going to be kind of maudlin. So unless we've made pretty good progress towards this new Artemis project landing a man and woman on the moon in a couple of years, that one might be kind of on the more maudlin side, but we'll see.
Okay.
You know, but it was a lot of fun.
How do you think the media handled the 50th anniversary?
That's a really good question. Pretty well. I haven't had a chance to see many of the documentaries. I've seen pieces of a lot of them. There was a lot of kind of, well, there are a couple that were exceptional. We talked about the CNN one. That was great. I thought the Nat Geo one was really good. There are a couple that were a little looser in their construction. And when I say looser, I mean, you know, not quite as close to the facts in some cases. But I thought most of them were really good. And the broader, you know, the print media and online and so forth did pretty well. It was just interesting for an old hack like myself who lived through it and has read this stuff 1,000 times to watch younger journalists. And in some cases, speaking mainly of like secondary outlets, you know, clearly not having a lot of mentoring or having enough time to really look up the stuff they're writing about. So a lot of it was a little flimsy, like, you know, there are a few articles I read that treated Apollo 11 like the only time we ever landed on the moon. And I thought, really, you guys?
Oh, wow.
There are a bunch of them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I know it was, there was a lot of saturation. I know that because every time, I would go on the computer or I would flip around on TV, that week leading up and on the actual anniversary day, there was stuff everywhere. So, I mean, it wasn't like people weren't unaware of it. They did celebrate it pretty massively on the media outlets that I was familiar with.
Yeah. I saw the same thing. And I'm glad. I don't know what's going to happen with this new NASA lunar initiative. Nobody does, but I'm glad it's at least starting to get some legs, because had this anniversary come and gone without something ambitious like that coming along for NASA, I think it would have had a little less impact. But because we've kind of got this bookending here of, hey, we went to the moon 50 years ago, it was amazing, now we're going back to stay and we're going to find water and do amazing things, I think that part was really good. So I think that helped propel it along.
And the latest book that you wrote about Apollo 11 sold like hotcakes, right?
It did. I think it was either in the fifth or sixth printing when the anniversary came and went. And weirdly, I was looking at Amazon the other day. They actually raised the price after the anniversary. So nobody can figure out what Amazon does. They don't ask the publishers. They just do their own thing. But, it's still chugging along.
Yeah.
So,
and people can get it, too. You can still get it. And there's you can check out all the information at pylebooks.com. That's P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. Yeah, it was interesting to see how the younger, as you've mentioned, like the younger people who don't really know about the space program a lot, because the popularity of the space program is more popular now than it has been in a while. But there was a period of time when nobody really followed the space program anymore after the after the 60s and into the 70s.
Yeah, and then kind of I think in the mid shuttle program before the space station was being put together, it got kind of quiet. And if you talk to people in their 20s and early 30s now, apparently, from everything I've been told and been able to look up, there just wasn't a whole lot of emphasis on this in public education. And, at least in where I live in Los Angeles, we're so desperate just to get the basics of STEM education going that I can see where they wouldn't spend a lot of time on this kind of thing because it was deemed as possibly unnecessary. But it's a shame because it really was the technological highlight of the 20th century. And it was done here in this country, and that's something I think young people should have access to.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was a good time. I'm glad that you've recovered. So
yes,
yeah.
I'm quite happy to be here.
All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. He is a space expert, author, journalist, editor in chief of Ad Astra magazine. We got a lot of space news and topics to talk about. And if you guys want to jump in here with any questions, Rod is here. If you got a space related question or a comment, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for any and all space related questions or concerns. So we'll get that going right if we break here. We got the news coming up right after this. All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Hey, Vic, in your news report there, man, it would be a real shame if they closed down Arlington.
I totally agree.
That's a beautiful place.
It's so fun too. It is a beautiful park and a lot of fun. I've taken my kids there to show them. It's one of those activities that a lot of young people these days just have never even experienced, but they're facing a lot of challenges, not just people, not as many people go out there. The purses aren't as big as they used to be. But there's a lot of other things too. Animal treatment at parks around, not this park, but there's been other parks that have gotten some, bad publicity lately because of horses dying. And, it's just one of those things that I think is, again, from kind of it's an activity that a lot of people used to take part in, not so much these days.
My dad and my uncle played the ponies all the time.
Yeah.
And would take me to the track. I've been to many of the tracks, all the back. We went to Balmoral, we went to Maywood, Sportsman, and Arlington. And Arlington is just a beautiful, beautiful track.
Wow. I didn't do it growing up because I wasn't near one. But, yeah, when I moved to this area, I started going, and I've been there several times.
Beautiful place.
It really is.
It'd be a shame if they close it down. I just wanted to mention that.
Sure.
I wasn't aware that they were thinking of closing it down that after the season.
You know, hinting at it. It's not been the
Yeah, they're
it's not been
sure.
a statement, but there, some of the things that they've said, yeah. And, you know, and the company that owns that racetrack, right, owns Rivers Casino,
mm-hmm.
and there was some thought, you know, that, you know, competing, you know, as far as opening a casino in Arlington now, you know, because they can be open new casinos now, they don't think that they're going to open one in Arlington because it would compete with the one that they already have in you know, the Rivers Casino.
Yeah. Well, I hope it stays around. It's just a beautiful place. And if people haven't gone there, you should. It's a really beautiful place, and it's fun to play the ponies, man.
It is, and we should probably say that the company that owns that racetrack, there is some rumors that they may be opening a casino in Waukegan. Just throwing that out there too.
All right, cool. All right, Vic, thanks, man. Let's get back to our conversation now. Rod Pyle is with us. He's an author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society. He's our space expert. If you have any space-related question or comment, we would love to hear from you via talk or text. Rod is here live, and it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Let's welcome Rod back to the show. Rod, welcome back.
Thanks. So if you lose your horse track, I say we set up some zero-G Chihuahua racing. What do you think? That might be kind of fun. Some people would think that was mean-spirited, but, you know, there's no impact on their bodies.
Yeah.
They didn't have to take all those drugs the horses take. There wouldn't be any losses. They just look really fun.
Yeah. All right. We'll figure that out.
Just a thought. Not a helpful thought,
yeah.
But just a thought.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, Rod, let's talk a little bit about some of these space stories, and we'll get to some other things as well that you want to jump into. Our morning man here, Steve Cochran, talked about this on his show and had some fun comments about it. But apparently there was an alleged crime committed in space. There was a space crime.
Let's talk
a little bit about this.
So there's a crew up on the station now, and one of those is a woman named Anne McClain. And she is alleged to have accessed her, separated, I believe, from her wife, and whose name is Summer Worden. And Summer made a complaint to NASA and the Federal Trade Commission that astronaut McClain had accessed Summer's bank account using the computers on the ISS, which, of course, are, you know, federally controlled. And I mean, this is beyond across space lines, state lines and all that kind of thing, beyond international even. So it gets really kind of thorny and weird. And even though it's not something that would by on its face be a felony or anything, it could either be very serious or kind of a shrug. Oh, well, you know, somebody went into their estranged spouse's bank account. Now, the astronaut's claim was, look, this is something we had done routinely. We were together. I'm participating in paying for her summer, the estranged spouse's son's care and education. So there's all these qualifiers, but the bottom line is there's a woman divorcing a woman and an accusation of illegal computer access. And what makes it so weird, of course, is it happening from space.
Yeah.
And although, what makes it simpler is that they're both U.S. citizens. And as space law is currently written, and there was an amendment to the original Outer Space Treaty of 1968, NASA did this, or the U.S. government did a special maritime and territorial jurisdiction set of laws that basically says, look, if you're a U.S. citizen in space, you do something naughty, you're covered by U.S. law. So they're both U.S. citizens. But what if this had been a U.S. astronaut stealing or beating up something from a Russian cosmonaut,
right.
Although I suppose the Russian cosmonauts would probably tell you that they're tougher than U.S. astronauts, but whatever the case may be. Now you've got this cross-jurisdictional thing, and what's, I think, most interesting about this story, other than the roots of it, is it's kind of waking some people up saying, you know, this could be, space lawyers have been talking about this for a while, they're a pretty rare breed, but this could become a much bigger thing, especially when you start getting tourists and private corporate astronauts up there.
Yeah,
then
yeah.
It gets really thorny.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a very strange story too. Like I've never heard that before. But it is the question of jurisdiction in space. That you said space laws. When were they written?
Well, there was the original Outer Space Treaty in 1967, which is basically meant to regulate activities voluntarily between the U.S. and the USSR, because we were the only spacefaring powers at that point. But a bunch of aspiring spacefaring countries signed on to it, some that were just flying satellites, none that were flying people other than the two countries I mentioned. But it was meant to look ahead and talk about, you know, no weapons of mass destruction in space, you can't claim territories and things like that. So a lot of it was kind of modeled along the Antarctic Treaty that was back from, I think, the 50s. But when you start getting into these more kind of specific areas of law, like interpersonal treatment and so forth, I mean, we don't even really have a working agreement on basic human rights in space because it's an international thing. So yeah. The U.S. has its set of concerns. Russia has theirs. China will certainly have theirs because they're spacefaring now and they've got people coming back and forth from orbit. So, you know, how do you iron that out? I mean, we will assume that access to oxygen and water and a place to use the toilet are basic human rights. But beyond that, it starts getting kind of sticky. So if you're talking about, let's say, there's a male-female couple from different nationalities in orbit and a claim of harassment is made, or maybe they're male-to-male, whatever the case may be, whose law does that fall under? The U.S. is going to make one set of claims based on our sensitivities here. And China or Russia or India or some other country would have their sensibilities and their legal statutes. So it's going to be really interesting seeing how this moves forward. And the only thing I've seen in terms of parallels that people are talking about at this point are, you know, looking at activities and concerns from long-term space simulations and people stationed in Antarctic bases, nuclear submarines and things like that, where you do start seeing aggression and occasionally sexual crimes and theft and those kind of things happen. So we've had a really good run with well-behaved astronauts for decades, but that's not going to last forever.
Yeah, no, well, that's the interesting thing is that this wasn't, you know, the amount of training and the amount of things that an astronaut would have to go through, you know, not just physically. You know, you're vetting these guys like crazy before they're allowed to go out into space. So that, so like a space crime or bad behavior in space wasn't really a big deal back when those laws were written up, correct?
Yeah, and although it was thought about at that point, there hadn't been much. That was 98. Since then, since the ISS started being occupied full time in 2000. There was at least one documented case of an astronaut, this wasn't a crime thing, but an astronaut going into a pretty severe depression and pulling away from everybody and displaying some troubling symptoms that got the doctors very concerned about possibly bringing, I think it was a him, back earlier and so forth. And, of course, that's when you start getting concerned about possible, you know, actions of malfeasance as well. But in that case, nothing happened. But, you know, people snap all the time. I mean, I personally... If somebody locked me in something the size of a cargo container for 6 months, I'd just be banging off the walls, you know, going nuts anyway. So yeah. I would be a really bad candidate for astronaut.
Yeah.
So like you say, they vet those people carefully, but you don't know how people are going to change and what kind of problems they might have. I mean, you could have somebody who would have a small stroke that wouldn't be diagnosed or something, and behaviors can change. So, yeah, it really is kind of the Wild West.
Yeah. Well, what's happening now with her? What's legally happening with her now? Is she still at the space station?
Yeah, she's not going anywhere. It's a 6 month tour. They're not going to fly her home for this. So the NASA's, I think Office of the Inspector General is looking into it. The FTC is either going to look into it or refer it. And at this point, they said we're just looking into it, but it's not a big immediate concern because it was, as far as I can tell, a one shot deal. And it's just something that, you know, she's been said, don't do it, told not to do it again. And we'll look into this and try and figure it out. So, like I said, I don't think this will turn into that big a thing. I'm kind of surprised it came up at all. It kind of feels to me like a little bit of a look how I can call you out in the public eye kind of thing from the estranged spouse. Because it didn't have to be referred to NASA. This is something that could have been handled by attorneys. But now it's big and noisy. And, of course, it makes a great news story. Because if you put the word space or tactical or moist before any other word or term, it suddenly becomes more newsworthy, right? That's I think what made it so sexy to the press.
Got it. Yeah, well, it's interesting. An interesting story. Brings up a lot of thoughts that we just had a conversation about for sure. Hey, Rod, hang on, okay?
You got it.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. He's our space expert. He's the best. He's an author, a journalist. He's written about 800 books. He is a space expert. So if you want to jump in here with any space-related questions or comments, the phone lines are open and the text lines are open. It's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We'll take a break here and come back and jump right back into the conversation with Rod Pyle here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the WGN Skyline Studios here on Wacker in downtown Chicago. We're live till 5 a.m., and that's when you can hear me, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requested now, one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. That's also the number to call or text if you have any space questions, space-related questions or concerns. It's 312-981-7200 because Rod Pyle is with us, author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine. You can check out pylebooks.com. We have a link on our Facebook page as well at facebook.com/NickDShow. Let's get Rod back on the air. Hey, Rod, welcome back.
Hey there.
All right. So SpaceX's Starhopper. It completed its final test flight. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it didn't last long, did it? I was kind of surprised. I probably should have paid more attention to it. But so originally it was built, I think it first showed up about a year ago, and it looked very much like a V2 or a cartoon rocket, a big silver kind of banana-shaped thing, very handsome, looked like a rocket. And then they had a storm. This is not in Boca Chica, Texas, where they're testing the thing, I guess. And they had a storm, and because it was basically what it's designed to do, hover and approach and landing tests for the Raptor engine, which is SpaceX's new high-power methane liquid oxygen engine. So it's really just a test bed. It doesn't matter how it looked, but it looked pretty cool. And then a storm came along and knocked off the top part of it because it was just made of sheets of hollow stainless steel. So Elon said, oh, it doesn't matter. They just put this kind of dome top on it. So it looked like, if you saw the video, it looked like a flying water tank, kind of almost like you'd see in a rural community or something. But it completed the top, went up to 500 feet about, which is what the FAA had restricted it to. And it only lasted about a minute, but that's all they needed. So I guess this is going to be parked and used as a static test stand now for engines, which makes sense. What I think is actually even cooler is they're now building Starhopper Mark 1 and Mark 2, which are going to be the new variants of this. They're going to have three or more of these engines, and they'll be intended for near or orbital flight. But what I think is really kind of neat, which Musk is doing, which is so Elon Musk, is he's having these two different versions done by different divisions of his company to encourage internal competition. So as if his management style wasn't enough to make it happen, he's got these guys competing internally, and I think that's pretty clever.
Wow. Okay. All right. Who names these things?
I think he does, because they change. As you know, the big Falcon rocket was originally, this is what this is building up to, this test stand is for the big Falcon rocket, which before that was the Interplanetary Colonial Transporter, and now it's called Starship, and the first stage is the Falcon Ultra Heavy, and, you know, I'm sure it'll change again before the thing actually flies, but, you know, this is a guy who sells flamethrowers online and digs tunnels under Los Angeles because he thinks it's cool, and now he just came out with a line of Nuke Mars t-shirts because he's been talking in the media about, hey, if we want to terraform Mars quickly, let's just set off a bunch of nuclear bombs over the poles and melt the ice caps and, you know, it'll give it a denser atmosphere. And there's just some reason to think that may be right, but people just, it leaves a real bad taste in your mouth when people talk about using nuclear weapons on other planets.
Yeah, that's a little strange. That's a little strange. But so Elon Musk sells flamethrowers. I love
Did you see him?
I'm sorry?
Did you see him when he brought him out?
No, I didn't.
It was just one of these things, you know, at least the Nuke Mars t-shirts kind of relate to SpaceX.
Yeah.
This was just, he wanted to sell flamethrowers. He thought it would be cool. And I think it shoots about 15 feet or something. It comes with all the appropriate warning stickers and so forth. But I mean, these are worse than the toys you and I grew up with, which were pretty dangerous already.
Yeah.
You could shoot plastic bullets in your sister's eye or something.
Yeah.
And I've got a flamethrower. That's a bit much.
I remember, yeah, you dangerous toys, man. They, you know, it's amazing. It's amazing that people around my age or your age have survived. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
We would have like chemistry sets and... How about this one? How about the wood-burning kit? You remember the wood-burning kit?
Yeah. Right? Oh, it worked really good on the palm of your hand,
exactly.
Too.
That's just, it's basically you're giving a seven-year-old a soldering iron.
I know. And do you remember, did you ever have a Gilbert chemistry set?
I did.
Did they still have the magnesium strips in it when you got it?
Yes, they did.
Boy, those things burn like nothing else, right?
Yeah, yeah. No,
what else are you going to do with
Tom,
it?
Tom is in shock. Tom's young. He's 25. So yeah. He doesn't know that this that's for
that is so dangerous.
No, that's for real.
That is blindingly dangerous.
Yeah.
It is blindingly dangerous. And of course, if you drop it, you go, oh, that really hurts. I'm burning my thigh. You know, I'm going to put it out with water.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't do anything. It just keeps burning.
Yeah.
And there were no, as I recall, because this was a big metal box with little bottles of, you know, had sulfur and magnesium and everything but gunpowder. Although you could make gunpowder.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And, but there weren't really any instructions not to do that.
Right.
They assumed a certain level of parental involvement. And I don't know about you, but my parents were out making a living. They didn't have time to worry about that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Like, no.
Okay. Have fun with your chemistry set. Don't hurt your sister. You know?
Yeah. Well, I've talked about, you know, like just like playing outside in the 70s was dangerous. We would, if I didn't come home with a cut, it wasn't a successful day. You know,
well, if we didn't have at least one experience with a puddle of gasoline and a bunch of matches crammed into a metal pipe trying to make a rocket, I didn't consider it to be a successful day. And I still can't believe that nobody got hurt. I do know one guy who was experimenting with rocketry as a young lad who actually, they had an explosion and a friend of his died.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, stuff like that did happen. But fortunately, most of the toys that Mattel and Gilbert and Marx and those guys put out look more dangerous than they were. But, yeah, you're right. Occasionally, I mean, creepy crawlers. Remember those?
Oh,
that goofy oven?
Yep.
And you could put a real singe on the side of your face with that. You, younger members of your audience are listening going, what are these two old duffers talking about?
Yeah,
I don't remember any of that.
You know, and then, you know, you had Shrinky Dinks, which is that's when the kids can play with the oven. Another thing.
Oh, those are the little plastic things that you cooked and they shrunk and
That's another thing is they were plastic. You'd put them in the oven, which is just weird to put something plastic in an oven and cook it. And then just to have like an 8-year-old trying to deal with an oven, it just seems wrong. But that was par for the course, though, man. I mean,
and they were really hot when they came out. They could burn you very nicely. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Do you remember the? I don't want to go on about this all night, but do you remember the Whammo Air Blaster?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And, you know, kids would put that up their friend's ear and go, look at this, pop, and there goes your eardrum, you know? I mean, who thought about that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
I didn't.
Yeah, nobody thought about that. All right, Rod, hang out, okay?
All right.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. We were reminiscing about dangerous toys. That's for real, Tom. That was for real.
Is the mascot of the 70s a kid with just like an eye patch and a missing hand or something?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah. It was fun, man.
I'm sure it was. It does sound like fun.
Everybody hang on. If you guys, if you're on hold, hold on a second. We got to take a break here. We got the news coming up, and then we're going to come back and talk more with Rod about space. We have more space stories to talk about, and if you guys want to jump in with any comments or if you have questions space-related, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for more with Rod Pyle. And again, you can check out his, we have a link on our Facebook page if you want to check out his website, look at his books and all that cool stuff. That's facebook.com/NickDShow. And you can also go directly to pylebooks.com. That's P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. All right, let's take a break here. The news is coming up right after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the WGN Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here every morning from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran has your morning drive at 6. It's Thursday, AAA Thursday. We'll get to that a little bit later. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. Joining us right now is Rod Pyle, author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine. He is a space expert. We're talking all things space. If you guys have a question, a space-related question or a comment, Rod's here live. He'll be happy to answer it for you. You can talk or text us right now at 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you. So I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What do you think of what you've seen for the movie Ad Astra so far?
It looks weird.
I'm not quite sure
what to make of it just yet. It looks a little strange. This is the new Brad Pitt movie that comes out at the end of September, September 20th. It comes out, but I'm not sure what I'm not sure what to make of it just yet. But what about you? What do you think?
Well, same thing. You know, I saw the ad for it. Of course, it caught my eye because I thought, oh, that's the same name as the magazine I work on. That'll get us a few search hits. That's good.
Yeah, yeah.
So I looked at the trailer, and then I was kind of scratching my head. I thought, okay, so he's going after Dad at the ends of the solar system. Dad went off to look for alien life, and from what I saw, clips of Tommy Lee Jones, that movie, it looks like he not only found it, but possibly became alien life. But that's another story.
Yeah.
But using technology that looks very kind of 1970s, you know, chemical rockets and old-fashioned-looking spacesuits and helmets and stuff. So there's obviously some kind of a, you know, visual theme, some kind of jive that the art director got their head wrapped around. That's fine. And Matthew McConaughey's not in it, so I consider that a big win right up front. Just had to say it.
I know.
But it feels a little bit like Interstellar in that it's got this kind of slightly off-kilter, rangy sort of big concept script idea. And what I've been able to read, so I saw the trailer, I looked it up on Wiki, and then I looked it up on IMDb, and I kept looking it up, and I was looking for a plot description that would really kind of tell me what it was about, and so far none of them have really.
Yeah, no, it's I've seen the commercials for it, I've seen the trailer, and I looked at the IMDb page, and I still can't make heads or tails out of what it's really about. I do not know.
We know he's on Earth, Pitt's on Earth. He's an astronaut. He's been doing a great job. It's the height of his career. And then the next thing you see him climbing what looks like a space elevator going up, you know, near to orbit or in orbit, and something bad happens and it goes kaboom, and now he's falling and falling and falling and starting to heat up. And then they cut to him waking up in an infirmary, and the big general who comes stomping in says, "We have a secret mission," and the next thing you know, there's Donald Sutherland, because there's always Donald Sutherland in these movies.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of it. You know, you don't see anything what's happening beyond that. So I'm looking forward to it, but because I think Pitt's great. I mean, he's really aged into his skills incredibly well. I just saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood last weekend, and that was sensational.
Yeah.
But I'm scratching my head on this one.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll agree on this one.
Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. I love the fact that Donald Sutherland is in it, because Donald Sutherland was, of course, in Space Cowboys. The Clint Eastwood movie, and that's a movie that I really love. Now, how do you feel about Space Cowboys?
The problem is they always get the shuttle technology wrong, and the physics are kind of messed up in the places they go to.
Yeah.
You know, so the landings and there should there be more gravity? Should there be less gravity? Would there be ice volcanoes? Is it dangerous? How is this space shuttle continuing to blast along when it no longer has an external fuel tank and no internal fuel supply, that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
But, and I don't remember, I'm probably getting it mixed up with Armageddon, because they were kind of, oh, forgive me for saying this in advance, they were kind of a similar class in my mind.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, no, I actually really love Space Cowboys, and I hate Armageddon.
Armageddon?
Oh, yeah, I hate that movie. I hate that
because,
movie. My producer likes it, but I can't stand that movie.
It's an American masterpiece.
Did you hate it because of the kind of posturing and all that?
Oh yeah, I mean it's Michael Bay at his bayest, you know. and I mean the movie. Yeah. I just think this is so stupid. And I'm not a fan of Armageddon. But now, Space Cowboys. Tommy Lee Jones is in that too, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Tommy Lee Jones and Donald Sutherland. Right, okay. And who was he? So it was Clint? Wasn't there a fourth? Was there a fourth space cowboy, or am I nuts? Because I know it was.
No, I think you're right.
Clint, Donald Sutherland,
I don't remember who it was.
Tommy Lee Jones, and I can't remember who. I can't remember who the fourth one was. Maybe somebody knows. I don't know.
James Garner.
There you go.
Yeah,
there it is, James Garner. Yeah.
I mean, how can you miss with that cast?
No, know? It's a great cast, and I thought it was a very entertaining movie, and I loved all of the, you know, Rod, I loved all of the stuff that they had, you know, the tests that they had to go through, and I thought all that stuff was really funny with the old guys going through the training and everything.
Yeah, and I was in a particularly sour mood about that time that movie came out, so I should probably give it another viewing because it's been a long time.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's probably better than I remember it being.
Well, so. We'll find out about Ad Astra. Now, what about this other one? Have you seen the trailer for Lucy in the Sky?
No, I don't know anything about it. Tell me.
That's a new movie with Natalie Portman, and she plays an astronaut. And this is another one that's being very vague about what it's about. Guy who wrote and directed it is the guy behind Fargo, the TV show Fargo. And so I'm interested in that because I love that show, and I think he's a very interesting writer and director. I'm not really certain about what it's about. She seems to have gone into space and changed when she came back. Like something weird happened. And John Hamm is in it as well.
Cool.
Yeah. So here's what it says. It says astronaut Lucy Cola returns to Earth after a transcendent experience during a mission to space and begins to lose touch with reality in a world that now seems too small. So that's what it's about.
It's kind of broad, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's
interesting. Maybe, I mean, so do you think it's a psychological drama?
I don't think there's any sort of like weird like body changing in it. I just think that she is affected deeply by what she did on this mission, and it really starts to affect her personality. And it's got Natalie Portman, John Hamm, Zazie Beetz, Chicago's own Nick Offerman, Ellen Burstyn. So it's a really good cast, and the director
is a good cast.
And the director is responsible for the TV show, one of the best TV shows on television. And so I'm really curious about it, and I hope it works out. And that one comes out in October.
That sounds good. Now, what have you heard about Picard?
I don't. Which one is this now?
So Picard is
Picard. Yeah. Oh, right,
Star Trek. Yeah,
I don't know. Is that on All Access or is that
All Access?
So it's CBS All Access.
Yeah, it's on All Access. Yeah, again, it looks interesting, and he looks great, and of course he's a great actor. But I just wonder what they're going to do with it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are. I will say this: a lot of people seem to be very excited about it because you know, obviously, he has a lot of fans. Patrick Stewart's got a lot of fans.
Oh yeah,
and so people
every time he walked into a scene, your eyes just went there, and suddenly you just tuned out everybody else.
Yeah.
Shot, right?
Yeah. And I mean, Star Trek Next Generation is intensely loved by people, and I think a lot of people are very excited about Picard. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that's going to be exciting. I can't wait. And it's great to see somebody, not that I got a personal stake in it or anything, but it's great to see somebody older getting a role like that in television.
Sure.
So it's not always she's 22.
Right,
white hot, and the very best we've got. And
yeah.
Well, how does anybody get to be the very best at something when they're 22? But that's television.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Patrick Stewart. I particularly liked him. I mean, I like him in everything, but I particularly liked him in Logan with Hugh Jackman, which is, I think, a pretty magnificent movie and a really great movie. It's my favorite comic book movie. I just think it's an amazing film, and he's great in it. So. Hey, we got somebody on the line here. Our old buddy Doc has a question for you. Hey, Doc, go ahead.
Hey, I love it when Rob's on. But let me first say that it's now Professor McConaughey. So
that's right. You heard about that, right? Matthew McConaughey is now a professor at University of Texas.
Of what?
He's teaching a script to screen screenplay class.
Okay, well, let me just say, if I may, since I have a background in academia, I believe he's probably an adjunct lecturer, but I'll look it up just to make sure.
Yeah.
Professor might be. But,
I still have a relevant question, though.
Okay.
you know, here on Earth, you know, our politicians will politicize everything on our environment. I don't think we can get any consensus among scientists and the Paris Climate Accord. And when it comes to what's happening now with our air, melting of water on the caps, 60 Minutes just reran this story about the effect and magnitude of plastics,
yeah,
and what that's doing to birds and fish.
Yeah.
My question is, are we getting any data from space and our work up there and from all these satellites that would help us better understand the nature of what we're doing to our planet and the magnitude that might help us get a better consensus of what is going on and what we could possibly be doing?
That's a good question. That's a great question, Doc. What do you think, Rod?
That's an excellent question. I'm so glad you asked it. So I have a particular viewpoint on this, I guess, because of the time I spent working up at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is NASA's field center on the West Coast here, which is devoted all to robotics and Earth observation and deep space exploration. So, yeah, there's a ton of data. And, I mean, most of the data we have, really, really good, solid, overarching data and observations on climate change and global warming and so forth, come from orbit, low Earth orbit, and some from geosynchronous orbit, some from the space station. And when you start talking to folks at NASA about this, the news isn't particularly good, and there isn't a lot of disagreement. They may disagree on what the causes are, but the effects are pretty clear. Glaciers are melting, CO2 levels are rising. There's concern about these things called clathrates up in the Arctic tundra that are these big methane reserves that may start to melt and open up, and so on and so on and so on. The disagreement is on the political end, and when Trump came into office, for better or worse, depending on your point of view, one of the first things that was done in the new NASA budget was to literally start turning off Earth observation missions because that data was no longer deemed as being important or relevant or necessary, to the extent that there was one instrument on the space station that was already installed, already running, already observing the Earth. It was completely passive. It cost about $1.8 million per year to run, with an M, not a B. So it cost almost nothing. And that was cut in that incoming NASA budget, which I calculated actually that amount of money was about the cost of Secret Service for a weekend at Mar-a-Lago, just coincidentally.
Yeah.
So to not ramble too much, the answer is yes, there's a lot of really good data. Yes, it does give us a lot of information that would help to understand how to better solve the problem. Or you see it in the news this week with these Amazon fires. Those
yeah.
are all observed and charted and documented from orbit. The question is, what are we going to do about it? Who's going to pay for it? And how can we get the politicians to agree?
Right.
The science is pretty solid.
Yeah, no, and Doc, yeah, I mean that's a great question, but man, everything is
thanks for it.
Everything is politicized, Doc.
I'm wondering when do we get to a point of no return? Because as important as the air is, you know, we as organisms are a large percent water, and our planet is a large percent water. And just watching this thing on 60 Minutes about these countries that are just putting trash in the rivers, letting it flow into the ocean, and then it's breaking down, and I could see that getting to a point of no return.
Yeah.
And then the damage that's wreaking on both fish, the coral reefs, birds, I mean, that's really scary.
It is scary stuff. It is scary stuff. Doc,
it's all scary, yeah.
Doc, I appreciate your call, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
Thanks, Doc.
All right, there's Doc. Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is here. We got to take a break. We'll come back. More questions for Rod, space-related or otherwise, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Always love it when Rod Pyle is here. We have a link to our to his website on our Facebook page, too, so make sure you check that out. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he blew our minds. There's a All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Triple Play Thursday, and that'll be coming up a little bit later on. That's One Artist, Three Songs, 312-981-7200. We are going to talk about some of the best album covers of all time. We lost a great local artist. Pedro Bell passed away, who did a lot of beautiful pieces and also designed really cool and iconic album covers for Funkadelic and other artists. So we thought we would talk about some of the best album covers of all time. Weird World Records also coming up this morning, and our phone number is 312-981-7200. Rod Pyle is with us. If you have any space-related questions or concerns, anything about that, we would love to hear from you. Either talk or text us at 312-981-7200. Here is Rod. Rod is back. Hey, Rod.
Thanks. How are you doing?
All right. So let's talk about the humanoid robot that the Russians had delivered to the space station. Let's talk about that.
So there was a Soyuz that launched last week, and they tried to do a docking. And Soyuz is used to carry both crews and cargo to the International Space Station. In this case, it was actually an uncrewed Soyuz that was just carrying cargo. And the reason they did that, usually they use a different spacecraft called Progress, which has this multiple backup automatic docking system and remote control in case the automatic systems fail and all that. But they were testing this new rocket for the manned version of the Soyuz, the crewed version. So they said, okay, let's just load it up with cargo as long as we want to test it without people in it, and we'll go ahead and make a run up to the space station. So they did that. The docking was not successful, the automated docking, and they didn't have a remote control backup. So the short version of the story is they had to move another Soyuz capsule to open up a different docking port that has a different docking system, and they finally got it docked. Mm-hmm. So, yay, that's good. On board is the Fedor F-850 Skybot, which looks kind of like a more aluminized version of the Terminator a little bit.
Oh, wow.
His outside skin's been burned off. I mean, it's not that scary looking, but it is very humanoid. Now, this isn't the first robot up at the space station. They had the Robonaut 1 and Robonaut 2, which were built by NASA and General Motors, which were roughly humanoid. And they had, I think we talked a couple of installments ago about the Astro Bees, which are these little kind of like cube-shaped robots that fly around with fans inside the space station and deliver tools and do observation and that kind of stuff. But Fedor, this F-850 robot, looks like a 6-foot-tall, scary robot. And they term it a social companion, whatever that means. No, not what you're thinking. And the idea is, it can work with human tools in conditions that humans would normally do, but might be too dangerous or too routine to waste an astronaut's time on, or maybe it's too risky to go somewhere. So because they have hands and feet and legs and all that, they can actually adapt to whatever it is that humans normally use. What was really kind of chilling about it, if you saw the video, was they're showing this thing stomping around and looking at people and mimicking human movement and all that. They have a shot, only in Russia, they have a shot with this robot with two handguns on a firing range, knocking out targets one after the other perfectly. I mean, he didn't miss a single shot. There's shells flying everywhere. The guys operating them are grinning ear to ear. And I thought, you know, NASA wouldn't do that. That's very much a Russian space agency thing.
That's funny. That's really funny. I'm looking at a picture of him. Google imaged him. He's a little creepy. Yeah. He's a little creepy looking. I really want to see the footage of him, you know, shooting guns. That's
yeah. And you know, as creepy as any humanoid robot is that doesn't have skin or anything, at least if you give him two fake eyes, you can kind of relate to it. But it's this big head with just one eye.
Yeah,
which makes it even a little spookier.
It is.
So yeah, you wouldn't want him to get upset. And you know, I think they still carry a firearm on the Soyuz. It's locked in the Soyuz capsule, but it's designed in case they have an emergency landing and you know, unexpectedly rugged area where there might be bears or something.
Yeah.
So they carry a firearm that has never been used, obviously, in flight. But you know, that robot's a little gun happy and might want to guard your pistol on the spacecraft.
And how long is Mr. Skybot F-850 going to be up there?
I think a couple of years, mm-hmm. Unless there's a breakdown. They had Robonaut up there from 2011 to, I think, 2014, then had to bring it around for refurbishment because it was having some problems, because these things are experimental and they're working at zero G, so yeah. The stresses and torques and stuff are different. But again, it's an experiment, and you know, we'll see how effective it is. It's kind of interesting because these things are big and bulky, and the space station is not that roomy an environment, so you kind of wonder, I don't know where they keep them, you know, and when they're operating. I guess that's just part of their experiment load for that day, so you just make room for it. But you'd think something that could kind of be a little more compact or roll up on itself or something would make more sense. But
they don't ask me, so I don't tell them.
There you go. All right. Well, if you want to see Skybot, just give them a little Google image search. It's pretty interesting. Rod, hang out, okay?
You bet.
All right. Rod Pyle is with us. He's great. He's an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society. He's a space expert. You can check out pylebooks.com to see all of his stuff. If you have any questions concerning space-related stuff, text or call us right now at 312-981-7200. Going to hit the news right after this.
Going down, welcome to the Space Jam. Space Jam. Here's your chance, do your dance at the Space Jam. All right. All right. All right.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and we are talking with Rod Pyle. He's a space expert, author, has written several books, and is answering your questions, and we're talking about some space stories in the news and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text if you want to join us. Let's get back to our conversation with Rod. Rod, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right. Here's a weird question that we have from the 803 or 804 area code who texted this in.
Okay.
Does the space station use a Roomba?
Not that I know of. They have to because you dust doesn't settle and dirt doesn't sit on the floor like it does when you've got a 1G full gravity environment. So all the dust and dirt just kind of floats around and stays in the air. So most of it's picked up by filtration in their air recirculation system, but they do have little handheld vacuum cleaners where they can go into crevices and stuff. So, you know, if somebody's, I don't know, eating a cracker or a piece of toast or something, which they probably don't allow in there. But anyway, if somebody's got something with crumbs in a corner and they need to go get them out of there, they've got little mini vacuum cleaners they can use. And in fact, I was reading a couple months ago, I was looking up for another one of these interviews about the benefits of the space program. I realized the original battery-powered dustbuster has some connective tissue descended from one that was designed for lunar module because of how much moon dust they were afraid was going to be in there. And they, coming in with the astronauts after the moonwalks, and they didn't want to foul the switches and all that kind of stuff. So they had a little, there was an early version of the dustbuster.
Oh.
The lunar module.
Oh.
Yes.
All right. Well, there you go. So no Roombas necessary. All right.
No Roombas, but the Astrobees are kind of like that. They just don't have vacuum cleaners, but they do fly around robotically and check on things and observe, you know, pieces of equipment in the space station and so forth. They're kind of like a Roomba. Yeah.
All right. Very cool. Okay. Here's Paul on WGN. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Nick. On the space station, how much spare time do they have?
Not much. Actually, I think we talked about this in one of the last couple of segments on the show. Up to half their time is spent at this point just doing maintenance and routine preventive maintenance and repair chores because the station's almost 20 years old. So between that and trying to keep up their load of science experiments, they also have to exercise up to 2 hours per day just to keep their bodies from falling apart because there's no gravity there. So, yeah, their schedules are really filled. So when they do get a few minutes to go float up and look out the window at Earth or something, that's very precious time. It's a good question.
Wow, okay.
Do they get satellite TV?
I don't know if they get satellite TV, but they do get feeds from NASA. So they do have media feeds. They can get the Internet. There's a certain amount of programming and obviously audio that they can get. And they can make phone calls. They can talk to families. They often will call down to school classrooms and have live chats with kids in certain jurisdictions. It's kind of a gift from NASA to the community. But, again, there isn't much time. So usually if they're not working or eating, they're wrapped up in their sleeping bags trying to catch a few winks so they can be at it the next day.
Wow. All right.
Okay. Thanks,
Paul. Good question.
I bet.
All right.
Thanks, Paul.
All right. Here's Donald on WGN. Hey, Donald.
Hey, my question is about teleportation. I've read that the scientists have worked with this and that they've been able to teleport particles, maybe even if they're microscopic particles, using some quantum physics where a thing can be on Earth and then be out in space and then maybe back again. Is this technology being explored possible? It's all like the Last of the Star Trek things, you know.
So, like the is teleportation at all feasible?
It's one of those things that always feels like a bridge too far in science, you know. So a couple of years ago, I wrote a book called Blueprint for Battlestar, which is all about the science of sci-fi. And that was actually one of the first chapters that the publisher and I started talking about. I looked and looked and looked and looked and read and scratched my head and talked to people. And I finally had to bail on the chapter because it was just too far away. So apparently there had been some work done, I think here and in China, where people were claiming that there had been some basic teleportation, as you say, on a quantum level. But exactly how it worked, I don't remember. I do remember that it was something where I think if you were going to move a one-inch cube of metal, it would take like, 2,000 years or something like that to do it. So it's not practical yet. They're obviously at the very, very earliest stages of this, and what the future is, I certainly don't know, and that's why I had to toss the chapter out. So I'm sorry I can't give you a better answer, but it is just at the very barest beginning.
Okay. All right, Donald, thanks for the call. If you're going to do the teleportation thing, make sure you don't get into the pod with a fly. That's not a good thing.
Yeah, and don't mistake their microwave for the transporter. That's a bad afternoon, right. Too.
Yeah, exactly. So you wrote a little piece here that I have in front of me about sweating rockets. That was a band I was in, I think, in college. Sweating rockets?
So this is another Elon Musk story. So he's trying to find ways for this big Starship rocket, which is going to be flying, we hope, to Mars and eventually and landing on Mars and then coming back and landing on Earth. Mars is a tough place to go because it's got enough gravity and just enough atmosphere to be pesky, but not enough atmosphere to really make parachutes work the way we like them to work and slow down an incoming spacecraft enough. So you have to use rockets when you're trying to land, but you also have this period of time where you're just coming in like the shuttle used to on a heat shield. And because he wants Starship to be reusable, he's trying to figure out a way not to use ablative heat shields, which is what it's called that they use on the Apollo capsules and the Orion.
Yeah.
The new spacecraft. The shuttle used heat tiles, but they're really delicate and they're expensive and all that. So the long and short of it is, he said, okay, let's look back at some old NASA and Air Force technology and experiments. And one of them was drilling little tiny holes all over the hull of the spacecraft and pumping fluid, whether it be water or methane from the fuel supply or some other liquid out, that vaporizes the second it exits the spacecraft and forms this kind of, it's not really a heat barrier, it carries the heat away with it as it's traveling through the heat of the atmosphere. So in effect, the rocket is actually sweating. And it was researched, as I said, by the Air Force and NASA in the 50s and 60s, looked promising, but we were in a hurry to get to the moon, so we just went with these burn-off heat shields that we made. But there was actually one, I can't confirm this because I could only get two sources, but there was one program that NASA was going to use in a space capsule for a single astronaut, this method for coming home, which would include mixing the astronaut's urine with whatever water was left over in the system to create this vapor heat shield for the spacecraft. So you'd actually have a P-cooled spacecraft.
Wow.
Which I thought was a pretty cool idea. I mean, that's recycling taken to the max.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Absolutely.
The only thing, so the problem that they're concerned about is if any of these pores get clogged across a reasonably sized area, you'd have a bald spot when you're reentering, and you could have a burn through. So people were asking, well, what might do that? Well, if you're landing on Mars and sitting there for a while, Martian dust could clog the pores. So you'd have to keep pumping air or liquid or something through them to make sure they're all clear. But as one engineer pointed out, he said, on Earth, while you're sitting there waiting for launch, all it takes is a couple of seagulls dropping their package on the rocket, and it could seal up an area maybe 3 inches by 10 inches long, which is enough to cause a burn through. So they got a lot of work to do.
Wow. All right. Oh, man. Elon Musk is just busy, man.
He's busy, and he's inventive as hell. And one thing I'll say is, he doesn't dawdle. If the technology that he's trying to do isn't working,
he'll hammer on it for a while, and then he just says, okay, that's enough. I'm pivoting. And that's something that's hard for government agencies to do, you know, because there's tons of paperwork and things to go through. When Elon changes his mind, you know, if he says, I don't want to make Starship out of composite anymore, I want to make it out of stainless steel because it's lighter and looks cooler, boom, decision made. He just goes and does it.
Yeah.
So that's pretty neat.
Yeah. All right. He's an interesting guy. He's an interesting guy.
Oh, yeah.
And you've met him.
I have not, actually. I've met his next in command, the president of the company, a woman named Gwynn Shotwell, who's incredibly interesting and intelligent. But I saw Elon outside the door talking to people. By the time I got out, he was gone, so I missed my chance to meet him. So one of these days. So that is one of my goals.
There you go. All right.
He'll probably look at me and say, hello, insect, or something like that.
Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. We got a few more minutes with him here till 3 o'clock. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Talk or text any questions that are space-related. 312-981-7200. More with Rod after this on 720 WGN. Right. Welcome back, everyone. How you doing? It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here. We are here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. We lost a really great artist. Pedro Bell passed away, and he was the guy who did some iconic album covers for Parliament Funkadelic. So we're going to jump into the best album covers of all time. And we might even get into the worst, because there's a couple of websites out there that show some of the weirdest and worst album covers of all time. So maybe we'll look that up, too. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, we're here. Rod Pyle is with us. You can check out Pyle Books, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. There's a link on our Facebook page. He's an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society. And he joins us usually once a month to talk space. Rod, welcome back.
Thanks, sir.
All right, we have a another question here. Steve is on WGN. Hi, Steve.
How you doing?
All right.
Awesome show as always. My question is: do they now, or will they ever have a webcam that people can, you know, like the general public, can go on and check and see possibly, but not necessarily the secret things they're doing, or, you know, just where they can observe what's going on at the space station?
At the space station, so like a webcam? Do they have the
like a webcam? You can go check it out, see like what's going on, and, you know.
Yeah.
So in other words, make the space station like a reality show kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Big Brother in space. Yeah.
So they kind of have that. If you go on NASA TV, which is usually a good thing to do right about the time you're getting ready to go to bed, because it'll help you get to sleep. Sorry, NASA, but it's often not very interesting. But one thing they do, they will often have an image from the station looking down on Earth. It's just this slow rotating planet below you. And then they do schedule, they have scheduled broadcasts from inside the station. But in terms of the public stream that goes out, there is not a continuous monitoring of what's going on inside, because those guys want their privacy too.
Yeah.
I think Mission Control has, so there's two major mission controls. One is in the U.S. and one is in Russia. They both have full-time video feeds of the common areas and some of the technical areas, but I don't think of crew quarters. That I'm not sure of, but as far as public consumption, sorry, you can't tune in whenever you want.
There you go. All right, Steve, thanks for the question. So astronomers find a bizarre planet that they say is unlike any other discovered so far. What's going on there?
Yeah, so with the whimsical name of HR 5183b, not that weird. It's a super Jupiter, so it's, I think, like three Jupiter masses orbiting a star. But what they discovered that's kind of weird about it was that it's got this really strange, like, egg-shaped orbit. So it goes way, way, way out from the host star and then comes way, way, way back in. And we're used to seeing orbits like that in our own solar system for comets, but not for planets. So that was the main part of that story that was kind of interesting. So it's got this 50 to 100-year orbit. And again, you know, there's a lot of – this is real Sherlock Holmes stuff, because the way – you're not seeing this planet because it's many, many light years away. You're looking at the wobbling of the star – ever so slightly, I mean, micro degrees back and forth, and guessing based on that or inferring based on that, it's not a guess, but inferring based on that, that there's a star orbiting it that causes that motion, excuse me, a planet orbiting that star that causes that wobbling of the star. So that's the extent they have to go through to try and figure out what is going on with exoplanets. And it just blows my mind that it works. But
yeah,
but they have found a few that they were able to later actually confirm using other methodologies. This is one of the earlier methodologies they had, because it's a lot easier to measure a star wobbling than it is to do other kind of observations. So the first one they used.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, another one of these things they named it HR 5183B. What's HR 5183? Is there an HR 5381A?
Probably. Well, B is the planet name, so HR 5183 is the star system.
Oh, okay.
And then B is the planet. So these names come from the the IAC, I think, the International Astronomical Congress, I believe it is. And, NASA will submit names for things they discover, and there's a size limit. So you only go down to, I think, small craters or something on Mars or the Moon, and then if it gets much smaller than that, the IAC doesn't have oversight, which is why on the Mars missions they get away with naming rocks goofy things like Scooby-Doo and Muskrat and Molehill and that kind of thing.
Right.
And they actually don't name them after copyrighted characters anymore, because sometime in the early 2000s, somebody in the NASA legal team woke up one morning and thought, hey, we could be a copyright violation for these Hanna-Barbera names we've been appropriating. It never happened. But so now they named them after, like, boring geological sites on Earth and stuff like that. Well, they're interesting to geologists. But anyway, yeah, so as we start discovering really cool exoplanets, and especially if we find one, you know, that we think we see a signature. Ultimately, when we have a big enough telescope, we might say a signature or something that looks like life in the atmosphere. We're going to have to come up with better names.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't do a public lottery, because you get stuff like Planet McPlanet Face and that kind of stuff. So you're going to have to do a little better. You know, maybe school kids, they seem to take it a little more seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Now, the last thing we want to talk about was this another rover to look for life on Mars. Tell us about this one.
So we got the Mars 2020 rover, which I think is still getting an official name. That's NASA's. That's going up in 2020. And that's going to have a small core sampling drill, which is different than the drill that went up at Curiosity and landed in a different area, and do some basic life science. But the one you're talking about is the ExoMars rover, which is from the European Space Agency. And that's launching in 2020 and landing in 2021, so not too far off from when the NASA one is landing. It's named Rosalind Franklin, who was a pioneer in DNA research.
Okay.
And it's an unashamedly astrobiology mission, so really the first one since the Vikings in the 1970s, the first landers we sent up there from the U.S., and the first successful ones, machines to land on the planet and operate. And it's good, you know, no holds barred, looking for life. So they're going to drive around. They've got a drill that can go down to, I think, 6 feet, which
wow.
is pretty remarkable.
Wow.
It's a rover.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you got to stand still 6.5 feet. And that's, you know, we'll see. I mean, we thought we had the same thing, similar idea going with the Mars InSight that had a self-hammering drill mechanism that has gotten hung up on rocks. So we'll have to see if this one works better. And, you know, there's another roll of the dice here, which is, once again, they've turned to the Russians for the Mars landing component of the mission. And, you know, Russia's not had a lot of luck with that. They put a couple of landers on the planet, but they only operated for a very short time or not at all. And they failed as recently as a few years ago with the Schiaparelli probe that the Europeans had on the first ExoMars mission. It was an orbiter and a lander, and then this one's going to be an orbiter and a lander and a rover.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the question mark is can the Russians pull it off this time? And I really hope they do, because they're way overdue for a success. They've been trying since the early 1960s, really, mid-1960s. So it's their turn, you know. So that's going to be an exciting mission if it lands properly. And, boy, if they are able to find, I mean, even just finding fossils of microbial organisms would be incredible. But if they found something living now, besides opening up all kinds of discussions about you know, how do you have life on another planet? What does that mean in terms of theology and metaphysics and everything else? It opens up another conversation about how careful do we have to be and how we approach Mars so that we don't kill off what's already there. Yeah. That's a tough one.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, one last question. This is Doug on WGN. Go ahead, Doug.
Okay.
Hey, I remember back when the space station was originally, started, they found or they established some goals they wanted to try to accomplish, and one of them was smelting metal at zero gravity. Did they ever do anything with that, and what happened?
Melting metal in zero gravity, is that something that's going on?
Are you talking about manufacturing techniques?
Yeah.
There was some research done on a very small scale. I don't know what the results of it were, but a certain amount of industrial processes has been a primary goal of that station for a long time. Most of it's focused on life science and biomedicine and that kind of thing, long-duration space flight. But there have been a lot of industrial processes investigated, some of them financed by companies on Earth. And actually, there's some of that done on the shuttle as well, because they had a fairly spacious experimental area in the back of the crew compartment. But I don't know a lot of detail more than that. I do know that they did send up a 3D printer a few years ago. That was only working with plastics. So it wasn't metal sintering. Mm-hmm. They're working on a metal sintering one. But they were able to do successful printing of 3D objects. They printed a couple of tools and so forth. And it's amazing. I mean, 3D printing is pretty cool as it is. But when you think about, again, you're doing it at zero gravity, so stuff is drifting all over the place, and you've got to worry about temperature control. And I interviewed the people that made that 3D printer for a couple hours. And they said, you know, everything from the exact substances they were using to seal the printer, because it had to be atmospherically sealed.
Right.
What's in the plastic, when it melts, you know, what kind of vapors are they emitted. And this is only vaguely related, but I read something the other day. It was actually an article in Ad Astra I was editing, where there's a program that sends books up to the space station for them to read to kids on Earth. And you actually have to use a NASA-certified supplied pen to sign the book, because even the signature might give off enough unwanted vapors that it could be a problem.
Wow.
Up there. So when you start talking about industrial processes like sintering or melting metal or casting or something like that, it gets very, very tricky.
So yeah.
They've done it on a very small scale.
Okay. All right, Doug, thank you for the call. Rod, always
thanks,
a pleasure.
Doug.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
Thank you.
And we'll get you back in here in about a month or so. And
let's get back together as soon as we see Ad Astra, because I just can't wait to argue about that.
Yeah, that sounds good. We'll get you on the opening weekend of Ad Astra. We'll get you Ad Astra. We'll get you in there.
And that'd be cool. Thanks.
All right. Pylebooks.com, PYLEbooks.com. We have a link on our Facebook page. Always a pleasure, Rod. You take care, okay?
Take care, Nick. Thanks.
There you go, buddy. Rod Pyle, everybody. All right. Let's take a break. The news is coming up right after this.